Today, I'm going to take you into Mr. Bolden's classroom, where we're going to learn about the history of broadcasting. Where do government funds come from, and how did we get from the beginning of broadcasting to that moment? So sit back, grab yourself a cup of coffee or whatever it is that you're into. You're listening to America Emboldened with Greg Bolden on the America Out Loud Network.
America Emboldened.
Greg, I feel emboldened.
You don't know the founding fathers. You don't know what they did. You don't know what they sacrificed. We have lost touch with the principles in the Constitution. Nobody's read the Declaration of Independence. You are voting for socialism, and you got what you voted for.
Welcome, Bold Americans, to another episode of America Emboldened. I'm your host, Greg Bolden, here on the America Out Loud Network. We've made it to the end of the week. It is Friday, TGIF, everybody. We've had a great run of shows this week. Thank you to so many people for sharing them, for following me on Twitter, at RealGregBolden. Going to continue to try to bring some quality content today. Make sure you're going to www.americaoutloud.com, where you can find my colleagues and all of their great shows, as well as the America Out Loud Talk Radio. So as promised, I'm going to take you into my classroom today to talk about the origins of broadcasting. How did we get from point A to point B? If you're a history nerd, you might like this show. If you struggle with history, I'll try my best to keep it entertaining as we go. I understand I do not have the multimedia version of this. You're hearing audio only. So I will do my best to be able to describe the things that I normally would show and listen to during this lesson as I teach my students. So let's get straight on started to it. I break up broadcasting into three specific stages. I start as a novelty stage. That's where people are playing with technology. They're trying to develop it. I then move into a hobby stage. That's where, you know, it's been developed, but now it's more of a hobby. They don't know what to do with it. And then entrepreneurial stage. That's where people, including the government, find ways to make money from it. So let's get straight to it. The first part of communications, when we talk about broadcasting, would be Samuel Morse's Morse code and the telegraph wires that got run all over the place. And we'd use Morse to tap dits and dashes in order to communicate with people. But there was a problem. We had to send wires physically to be able to have this. So people naturally were like, well, how would we transmit a signal through the air? What about wireless communications? And so this is the novelty stage. And so some important players that were necessary leading up to that time was, you've heard me probably mention this guy before, the name James Maxwell. James Maxwell had a theory that electricity, magnetism, and light are all manifestations of the exact same phenomenon called the electromagnetic field. And later, Heinrich Hertz proves Maxwell's theories and identifies electromagnetic waves. Now, part of this, we don't think about being humans. We don't think about all the radio waves, the cell phone waves, the internet, all of this that's beaming through your body 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, as well as all of the invisible light spectrum and invisible light spectrums that we don't see, such as gamma rays, X-rays, ultraviolet rays. Maybe you wear your sunglasses to protect your eyes from the ultraviolet rays. And then we get into the visible light spectrum. That's everything that we can see, the colors that are in front of us. And then we start getting into infrared rays, which, you know, we have infrared goggles that you can put on. We have ways to use that with cameras. We get into radar after that. We get into the FM band wave, TV, short waves, and up to AM radio type waves. And so we have these different wavelengths, and it was Heinrich Hertz that helped us understand that. And so we measure these waves in Hertz, which is a frequency of rotation. So 1 Hertz would be equal to 1 cycle of that frequency per second. 10 Hertz is 10, 30 Hertz, 30 times in 1 second. If you think about your music, 30 hertz is like a bass drum, and maybe like 30 hertz up to like 70 hertz, we would have a bass guitar. Once you get up to about 150 to 350 hertz, you're talking about the speaking voice that you have right now coming to you through your airways. Now, there's three different individuals who invented the device to transmit a signal through the air. And this was all in 1894. We have Guglielmo Marconi, we have Nikola Tesla, and Alexander Popov. But who exactly gets the credit for inventing wireless telegraphy? Well, that is Guglielmo Marconi. Guglielmo Marconi spent a ton of time trying to develop this, and he eventually was able to see that there was static electricity that was traveling. And so much like Benjamin Franklin put up a kite, tied a key to one end to see that electricity would travel down to the key, he would also use a sheet, almost like aluminum foil. He would tap the Morse with a electrical signal, and then he would observe that that signal was coming through on the other side of the room. After that, it began to be, well, how much further can we push this? Eventually gets across the English Channel, and eventually we get what's called ship-to-shore travel. Now, ship-to-shore travel in broadcasting became an entrepreneurial stage. This takes it straight from the novelty stage to people say, well, we got to get this on ships because it can help people know, SOS, save our ship. And so if you've ever wondered where we get these words, like the phonograph, the telephone, the telegraph, the root of those words for the wireless telegraph, tele means far off, graph means writing. So it's a far off writing that we are decoding on the other side. If it was a telephone, it's a far off sound. All right, so that's where we get the telegraph, the telephone, and eventually we get a phonograph when we start having records and Edison's device, which is able to have sound that is written. Now, the first person that's transmitting the wireless voice is the name Reginald Fessenden. He transmitted both voice and sound, and he becomes a revered figure in broadcasting. We then move on to Lee DeForest. Lee DeForest received his PhD from Yale in 1899, and he was the first person to amplify the sound. And so now we have amplified sound, we have communications that are not just Morse code, and so we are going to enter not just the hobbyist phase, but the entrepreneurial. So like I said, it goes ships. Now, pay attention, here's where it starts getting interesting. During the Titanic sinking, there's a young boy who's listening as a hobbyist, and he catches the Titanic's signal offshore. And his name is none other than David Sarnoff. Now, remember that name, David Sarnoff, because he's going to be really important. We talk about government-sponsored state media. We talk about how the government set all this stuff up. It's going to be really important. So anyway, Sarnoff hears this, and he's credited with helping to rescue a ton of people's lives. There were about 866 people believed to have been rescued, and about another 1,250 are believed to have died from the Titanic. But those 866 that were rescued was because of the wireless telegraphy. It was the ability to communicate via Morse code from ships, help save lives. Now we get into a huge hobby amongst rich families. And so we get in 1920s radio broadcasting news. Now, radio broadcasting news is a bunch of children, their families, they're playing with radios in the shops, they're making them. We even get Harper's Electricity Book for Boys, which is made by the Boy Scouts of America. And so the wireless age really comes in playing on the Boy Scouts and showing people, hey, here's this great new device that's coming out. People, when they first heard this, one person was quoted as saying, I remember it was 10 or 11 o'clock at night, and all at once this voice appears, and I remember letting out a yelp or a shout of some sort, and my dad, who had just gotten out of the bath, came in wrapped in a towel to make sure that something hadn't happened to me. I said, Dad, look, I hear this fellow talking. Now imagine the magic that it must have been back then in the 1920s to hear somebody's voice come through a speaker for the first time in your home. home. It had to be completely magical. And so tons of books started coming out. The Radio Boys First Wireless by Alan Chapman. That book came out. Then after that, Frank Webster had The Boys of Wireless. Tom Swift and The Wireless Message was written by Victor Appleton. So people started to romanticize all this. But before we got there in the 1920s, we had a Radio Act of 1912. See, you needed a license to operate a radio. It didn't take long for the American government to realize that this was a powerful tool. And they also recognized during World War I that radio would be an important war tool. So as a result, the United States wanted to control global radio. Now, let that set in for just a quick moment, that the United States felt that they could control the radio all across the world globally. They wanted to be the ones that controlled it. Now, this is all the way back in 1912. They're thinking about this more than 100 years ago. Now, in 1915, there were 20 companies that were selling point-to-point radio equipment. You had a company called AT&T, just a little company, General Electric, which was made in the United States, and American Marconi, which was made in Britain. Now, AT&T made the transmitters for radio, General Electric made the receivers for radio, and American Marconi made both. And Marconi was by far the biggest and best of those three companies. But guess what happens? The United States, they come up with a plan. They want to make sure that the United States is the most powerful radio technology controlled country in the world. So they establish a new company. That's right. The United States government establishes a new company anchored by General Electric, and they call it RCA, Radio Corporation of America. And what they want to do is pull all the different patents into one thing. And so RCA becomes a private sector monopoly. Now, they use General Electric, and I think I talked about this on a previous podcast, but I'm just refresh everybody. They use General Electric to weaken British Marconi because they decide they're not going to sell British Marconi the key components that they need. And then they buy its American assets, American Marconi, and put British Marconi out of business, which then really leads to a monopoly of RCA. And they use RCA to oversee the radio patents from GE, AT&T, Westinghouse, American Marconi, and the Navy. And they see this as a way to get to standardization. Now, even though RCA is a private sector company, do not lose sight of the fact it was set up by the government. They used this company in order to have standardization across all of radio. And this begins the American domination over all communication technology. Now, let's go over to Britain for a quick moment. In 1904, UK decides, yep, this is some great stuff that's coming out with radio, and they develop a state-supported broadcasting system. And the UK funds what's called the BBC, the British Broadcasting Corporation, which obviously still around to this day. And this is going to pave way now that we have standardization, we have state media and government fed media here in the United States through RCA. It's going to begin what's called the mass medium stage, which, by the way, guess who becomes the president of RCA way back when? Well, if you were paying attention earlier when I said about that, the boy who was listening into the Titanic, David Sarnoff, becomes the leader of RCA shortly after it's founded in 1919. And he works there in various capacities until his retirement in 1970. But David Sarnoff ends up becoming one of the most powerful individuals in all of broadcasting. He is extremely legendary in broadcasting. He is highly influential in development of both radio and television. So we're going to get to that as well during today's show. Now, radio at this point in time, by 1920, in Pittsburgh, there was a station called KDKA. They claimed to be the first station to broadcast both music and talk radio. And broadcasting now is coming out, and radio stations are starting to get set up. And by 1922, you're starting to hear your first advertisements. Radio, they say, is a democratic medium. It's for the people. And so they focus on education, religion, the working class, businesses, mostly jewelry stores, entertainment, and news. And so this starts coming out. You start eventually getting over to Tufts University. They make a broadcast in 1922. You have plays being put on this way. Westinghouse makes things more affordable. You have school classrooms that are listening to radio broadcast for educational purposes. And you even have people that are gathering in theaters to watch people broadcast the first shows. And so they're just watching the people do it. And then during this time, too, women start getting jobs putting the radios together because the men are over fighting World War I. So women now are put into meaningful businesses. Now, there are two key networks once this kits in. AT&T, and they have a network of a bunch of different stations. They link together with long-distance lines, and they call themselves the BCA, the Broadcast Corporation of America. Now, AT&T saw radio as a way to enhance the telephone business. They thought that this would be a great way to improve there. And then RCA, led by David Sarnoff, creates a network as a subsidiary linked with Western Union Lines, which was considered inferior. They were not as good as AT&T. And they create what's called the Radio Group with GE and Westinghouse. Now, let's not lose sight that RCA was propped up by the United States government in order to have this type of power, and they still had inferior services. So this ended up becoming the Broadcasting Corporation of America, AT&T, BCA, versus the Radio Group, RCA. And so that continues on for some time. Popular Science starts writing about it. And while this is happening, the government starts cracking down on AT&T because God forbid should they crack down on RCA. They're the ones that set that up. So they crack down on AT&T and they say you're monopolizing radio communications. And so they force them to sell part of their network. RCA organizes two networks in order to accommodate for AT&T. See how this happens? RCA swallows up AT&T based upon the government saying they needed to. And so we get NBC, the Red Lines, which is AT&T, and you get NBC Blue, which is the Western Union Lines. And that's where you get NBC, National Broadcasting Corporation, from. And so now we're getting into the big three networks. CBS was first, 1928, with William Paley. He uses option time to woo affiliates from NBC. ABC then comes after in 1941, and the FCC outlaws option time and forces RCA to sell one of its NBC networks, the Red and the Blue, which becomes ABC. And then by the 1940s, we now have NBC, CBS, and ABC, establishing the big three networks that last for like another 40 years until we start getting more networks. So to recap before we hit this break here and I get into the television side, some important things. The Radio Act of 1912 required a license in order to broadcast. The Radio Act of 1927 established what's called the FRC, which was the standard of operating in public interest, convenience, and necessity, otherwise known as PECON. And then the Communications Act of 1934 established the evil FCC, and it kept the PECON standard, and Congress endorsed commercial radio. Now, this is very important to kind of get from point A to point B. I did this in a brief 19 minutes, which normally I teach this over a very long period of time, but I hopefully you get the gist of everything, because when we talk about NPR, PBS being government funded, well, that's because it is. And as you can see, the government set up since the very beginning, since the very inception of broadcasting, they've had their hand in the pot. To say that anybody who is broadcasting right now is not a product of the government is a lie, simply for the fact that everybody still to this day, gives into FCC regulations, filing quarterly reports, filing everything that needs to get filed. And so it's very important. All right. Now, I would normally at this point in time continue to talk about the different phases of radio, talk about the important parts, but I'm just going to give you some before I hit the break that people ask me. They ask me, why the W, why the K? Well, K is designated for all the radio stations. It's military. It's designated for all the radio stations west of the Mississippi. W is everything east of the Mississippi River. There are several exceptions to that, but that's basically where it comes from. When we come back, I'm going to get us into the radio culture and how National Public Radio was set up and get into a little bit of that information, as well as talk about the television standards. All right, everybody, make sure you're going to AmericaOutloud.com. We got plenty of different products for you guys to choose from that help support the network and all of the talent that's coming through. We'll be right back. You're listening to America Emboldened with Greg Bolden on the America Out Loud Network.
Well, the Out Loud Truth was the rallying call that started it all. A wide spectrum of programming from world and political news to societal, your health, and cultural stories. 7 amazing years of news stories, informative podcasts, and great talk radio. America Out Loud Talk Radio. Liberty and justice for all.
If you're like me, you'd like life to return to some kind of normal. You're burned out on all the fear-mongering, but deep down you try and minimize viral exposure and your risk of getting sick. You've heard it talked about time and again by respected medical professionals. Use a povidone iodine nasal solution. I don't need to tell you just how powerful a nasal cleansing formula with xylitol, povidone iodine, and vitamin D3 for immune support could be. In fact, my attorney told me not to tell you. Google it and find out for yourself. Now, get yourself a bottle of American-made Cofix RX Nasal Solution. Let's get out and live again. CofixRx.com. That's CofixRx.com. Use coupon code OUTLOUD and get 20% off.
We know you love the versatility and portability of the Genesis Fogger, but sometimes you just want to set it and forget it. Well, we heard you. Introducing the UX4 HOCL Atomizer. This stationary unit quietly protects you and is perfect for smaller spaces. With over 250,000 units sold in Japan, it's now available in the United States. Visit genesisfogger.com/outloud to see the UX4 in action and receive a 15% discount on either Fogger with promo code OUTLOUD. With Genesis, you're ready for anything.
Welcome back, Bold Americans. Second half of the show is here. We're talking about the history of broadcasting and the American government's quest to have global domination. As you can see, just in that action-packed first half of the show, the United States government sets up the parameters to standardize all of communications here in our country, but they also put other businesses around the world out of business in order to do so. The FCC begins to put constraints on stations by the 1950s. By the late 1980s, it starts to grow until you get to the Telecommunications Act of 1996. But I don't have a ton of time to cover all of that today because I want to get to where did NPR come from? Why was there a need for it? Well, if you follow broadcasting and what was going on at the same time in television, these kind of overlay. So let me take you through the television history, and that we're going to catch up here in the second half of this second half, if that makes sense, and we'll get there. So television develops a little bit later in 1927. So radio has already been around now for a couple decades, but it's really taking off at this point. And so there's a young teenager by the name of Philo Farnsworth. I always tell my students, it's always the teenagers that are doing remarkable things. What was I doing as a teenager? I was trying to learn how to play guitar, play some Nirvana, maybe be in a musical here or there, play some soccer. I definitely was not as creative as some of these absolutely stunning inventors in history. So Philo Farnsworth patents what's called the dissector tube, which is very similar to the cathode ray tube, which gives us CRT television sets. Now, the CRT television sets, there is another guy by the name of Vladimir Zworykin. He's a Russian immigrant in America, much like David Sarnoff was. And he finally figures out the system with features of a modern picture tube that we'd see. And he does this by 1929. And he uses what's called an electron gun, a beam deflected vertical scanning coil, horizontal scanning corner coil. He has electron scanning beams. And then he's got his picture area and this coating that he puts on it. And he's able to reproduce an image. Now, there is no entrepreneurial stage here. Investors and venture capitalists immediately knew what to do with the television set. They didn't need to mess around with it like radio. And so televisions start premiering at the 1939 World Fair. And by 1941, guess who decides that they're going to create a technical standard? And this isn't a bad thing, by the way. I'll explain why in a second. Well, if you guess the FCC in the United States government, you're correct. In 1941, the FCC adopted what's called NTSC standards for the United States, and it was a 525-line image, and it scanned at 30 frames per second. There were two fields, one frame interlaced over the other. So if you were to pause, you'd almost have like two images on one screen, but it happened so fast as it made its way through that the human eye didn't catch that. The NTSC format is still used to this day in Canada, Mexico, South America, most of it, as well as in Japan. It had at the time a 3:4 aspect ratio, which would stay that way until we get the high definition, which was supposed to be in 1998, but it really pushed to like 2008 by the time everything was turned over. And there were 1,080 lines of resolution back then, 1080p, and 16:9 aspect ratio. That's when the televisions went to a rectangle. The FCC suspended licensing of television to finalize the technical standards from 48 until 52. So there's a TV freeze at that point in time. Again, the government getting involved, saying this is exactly how things are supposed to be. Now, why did I say it's not necessarily a bad thing? Well, I think standards are a good thing. I just wonder if we would have gotten to those standards or maybe better standards in the future because people would have been innovative and continued to push forward, or if the government stagnated growth early on so people didn't push. You could make an argument for both. Now, TV booms in the 1950s, and it's going to give way to NPR in just a few moments with radio. Most of the early programming took the radio shows and they brought it to television, which became problematic because you had radio shows like Amos and Andy, which were done by white characters that were talking as stereotypical black characters. And now they brought Amos and Andy to the screen in blackface. And then eventually the show casted a black cast. But there was a lot of stereotypes towards the black community that started because of television and radio. And I try to tell my students that that's one of the ways that stereotypes and things helped grow based upon the communications media. Now, during the 1950s, one of the worst things happened as well. Sponsors moved the television as well, which gave us the Colgate Comedy Hour, the Buick Burl Show, where they always had a Buick driving down the street at the beginning of every episode, the Camel News Caravan. That's right, Camel was bringing you the news, as I always say. Could you trust Camel not to tell you cigarettes are bad for you? Kind of like Visor on all the news stations. We got the Gillette Cavalcade of Sports and Goodyear TV Playhouse. So by the 1950s, they're all over there. We got NBC, ABC, CBS, all doing the broadcasting. There's not a lot of other stations before 52. Almost all the stations were affiliated with one of the big three, owned and operated NBC, CBS, ABC. We still have educational programming. So we got like nuns on television, we got mass, we got teachers up at the boards. But the problem is the programs looked really crappy. They had one single sponsor and the sponsors controlled all of the content. So therefore, people were saying, well, gee, there's not a lot of the differing views on this news hour. Now, there's a guy at NBC in 1952, Sylvester Weaver, that was called Pat. That was his nickname. And he increased the standard showtime from 15 minutes in 1952 to 30 to 60 minutes. And he also created the daily magazine format, the 90-minute to 3-hour long, such as the Today Show and the Tonight Show, and a show called The Spectacular. And then things start going downhill. The quiz show scandals hit. Congress has to get involved because there are sponsors now that are hiring the people that are going to win the money. And we find out that it's all a hoax. And there's a big boom. Just like radio boomed by 1948, 1% had TV sets. By the early 1960s, about 9 out of every 10 homes had a television set. They were all about making money. But the problem is, all the money that they were making, it didn't really seem to do much to improve the programming. And that gives us the Vast Wasteland speech, which is going to set up NPR with PBS and Newton Minow. Now, if you haven't heard Newton Minow before, let me kind of give you a little bit. So this is a speech where it was called Television and Public Interest, better known in my class as the Vast Wasteland speech. It was given by the Federal Communications Commission, FCC Chairman Newton Minow, at a convention of National Association of Broadcasters, May 9th, 1961. And it was the first major speech that he gave after he was appointed the chairman by then-President John F. Kennedy. He refers to the American television programming as a waste, a vast wasteland. And he says that programming needs to be in the public interest. He said the golden age of television is over from the 50s. He said that it was time for television to expand to praiseworthy shows. He said there were very few, such as the Twilight Zone, that were programs that were the exception rather than the rule. He said, when television is good, nothing, not the theater, not the magazines or newspapers, nothing is better. When television is bad, nothing is worse. I invite you each to sit down in front of your own television set when your station goes on the air and stay there for a day without a book, without a magazine, without a newspaper, without a profit and loss sheet or a rating book to distract you. Keep your eyes glued to the set until the station signs off. I can assure you that what you will observe is a vast wasteland. So as a result, just as the government always does, after this speech, they decide that they were going to help create meaningful programming. And they're going to do this by setting up a non-commercial educational television network, as well as non-commercial educational radio networks. And this helps pave the way for none other than PBS, Public Broadcasting Service, as well as NPR, National Public Radio. So hopefully now you're seeing how we got it. And I'm just on that halfway of the halfway mark. It's like I planned this and I didn't. It just happens to be working out extremely well right now. All right, so we have NPR being set up and PBS being set up because PBS gets set up in 1968, a few years later. NPR is finally funded by 1970. Keep in mind, the BBC has been around since 1912. So the government has a model of which they can follow along and help create this. They have a way that they can say, hey, we know what government state media looks like, and we want to set up something very similar to that. So let's take you through now the timeline of PBS NPR. So by 1973, there was formal lobbying to fund NPR and PBS permanently. It was, let's back up first. In 1967, the Public Broadcasting Act was signed into law by Lyndon B. Johnson, and NPR and PBS are born from this. There's also an organization called the CPB. Now, if you're not familiar with the CPB, that also is probably the starting point of this vast wasteland speech. And they become, after the Public Broadcasting Act gets signed into law, a nonprofit corporation in D.C., the CPB. And so the CPB stands for Corporation of Public Broadcasting. I don't know why I had trouble recalling that right now as I'm teaching this to you, but that's what their name is. And so they start overseeing the setup of PBS and NPR. By 1975, because when they first set up this act, they said that they would never fund permanently, so you have to ask for the funds each year. But President Ford signs a five-year funding effort, and in 1977, NPR gets their own people to do the lobbying to make sure they get money each year. By 1979, PBS is leading the way in television lobbying. They're in the homes with Sesame Street. People love that show. And so they're trying to get government to commit to funding long-term, and they fail. They fail so much that Reagan comes in, and Reagan cuts tens of millions of dollars from funding by 1981. And by 1983, NPR is in such bad financial shape, they have to start laying off their staff. People are losing their jobs. So the CPB loans NPR. Remember, CPB, incorporated in D.C., set up by the government for this, under this act, they loan NPR about $7 million to keep it afloat. Otherwise, NPR would have went out. By 1985, revenue hits $1 billion. This is a gamble by the CPB, and it wins extremely well. The CPB then establishes what's called a radio program fund to get grants. Now, these are government grants from different organizations, but you go through the government to get them. And there's a show called Fresh Air on WHYY, which was the first to receive a grant at the whopping amount of $875,000. Now, this is in the mid-1980s. That is a boatload of cash. By 1986, because NPR and PBS have turned things around, NPR is able to pay off the $7 million debt to the CPB. And you would say, well, gee, Greg, that sounds like they reclaimed their independence. Well, no, they still answer to the FCC. They still answer to lobbyists to make sure that they have their station. Can you imagine if you're being overly critical in your newscast and worried about how people are going to vote in order to fund you? Now, this is all needing to keep the government happy to maintain support, which is why they're lobbying. By 1992, George Bush required a Senate amendment that the CPB be monitored objectively for their balance. And in 1993, it was approved. Newt Gingrich then tried unsuccessfully to defund the CPB over next 2 years because he felt that public radio should be completely private to best serve the American public. They shouldn't have to get any funding from government. And the budget that he proposed would only cut about 17% of their expenses. We get to 97. Revenue was at about $2 billion 10 years later. NPR Public Radio International proposed a merger, and the boards declined. In 2000, the FCC reserved low power for nonprofits, and by the next year, the FCC allowed some revenues be made for public TV stations. That's important because, again, if NPR is telling Elon Musk and PBS that they're not government-funded media, they are liars. By 2004, PBS partnered with Comcast for PBS Kids, which blurred the line between public and private. And in 2005, both NPR and PBS had their own ombudsman doing their work for them in D.C., as well as being a liaison to the community. The CPB used their own ombudsman to try and bring more conservative voices to PBS. They felt it wasn't conservative enough at the time. And by 2005, the New York Times breaks a story that the CPB is influencing stories on PBS and their internal decisions. And this upends the trust of the CPB and NPR and PBS. Basically, if you're paying attention to that, that means the CPB was telling PBS what type of stories to air, what they wanted to see. And since the CPB had been funding all this time since the 1960s, keeping NPR and PBS afloat at their worst of times and continuing to have their hand in the pot in their best of times, this creates more crisis. And so by 2008, the housing crash, it created some turmoil, funding declined, and layoffs hit. And Obama was now met with, should he fund public broadcasting? By 2009, Congress issued $25 million to stabilize public broadcasting and save it. But, you know, this is the same public broadcasting that claims they don't get any government-funded funds to Elon Musk, and they take themselves off of Twitter. They invested, CPB got $420 million that year, and they invested $10.5 million to set up local journalism centers. Enter a man by the name James O'Keefe. Yes, that's right. Project Veritas, James O'Keefe, OMG, James O'Keefe. He exposed public broadcasting in 2011 when he showed that NPR was biased in reporting on the Tea Party because NPR's Shiller was fired for calling conservatives racist people. And then the president, also by the last name of Shiller, but not related, Vivian Shiller, she also resigned. And for the next decade, we've continued to have this argument about whether or not NPR, PBS, are government funded. Now, NPR will try to say, we only get 3% of our $300 million budget at this point in time from the government. But that's not taken into consideration state subsidies. It's not taken into consideration local money as well that are taxpayer dollars. That is not a true figure. And you get the PBS. PBS gets 31% of all of their money from the government. So don't tell me there's no such thing as state-sponsored, funded media here in the United States. In fact, if you go to allsides.com, they say that NPR now is a left-leaning journalism prospect, that they lean left in what they do. So let us not forget, the United States government, they've been involved in broadcasting ever since this thing began. They've propped up who they wanted, like David Sarnoff, into the positions of power ever since the beginning. They've put other people out of business on purpose to make sure that they could keep their standard, to make sure that they could keep their way. The United States government is not always the best for the rest of the world when it comes to their plans. And let us also not lose fact that the BBC has been state-sponsored controlled media since 1912. And so when we have the BBC working with Google, you got the BBC working with Reuters, Associated Press, Yahoo, all of YouTube, all these other organizations at the time they were working with Twitter with the Trusted News Initiative, I hope that you can see the writing on the wall and what Elon Musk is trying to do by labeling the different media companies government-funded, state-sponsored, or publicly funded. If you don't see it, then I gotta go back and figure out how to teach this lesson in a better way to you, my students, on this fine Friday morning, evening, afternoon, or if you're listening over the weekend, whenever it may be that you're listening, I appreciate it. But hopefully you've learned a few things. Hopefully it's been a nice history lesson. Feel free to send this to a friend. If you enjoy my show, consider going over to my Give, Send, Go. It's on AmericaEmboldened.com. That's my website. And as soon as you go on, you'll see that if you scroll just below the podcast player, it's a spot there supporting independent media with Greg Bolden. I got some trips that I want to do. I want to go out to Minneapolis and go to the world's quietest room and do a podcast there. I've been in touch with their labs, Orfield Labs. They invited me, and I need to fund my plane ticket or my gas to get out there, as well as do plenty of other stories. So bringing you this content Monday through Friday, if you'd like to be truly publicly funded, no government money coming anywhere from my show, completely independent journalism, media, and teaching people, then this is a show that, you know, if you can give a dollar, give a dollar. I don't care if you can't give, you know, $10, $20. Give whatever you can. You can give me 10 cents. I'll take your 10 cents. That's fine. Every little donation helps. And if you don't have anything to give, send me a prayer. Prayers are always a good thing. All right, everybody. I hope I honored your time well. I'm going to let you go. I'll be back next week with another round of shows Monday through Friday. As always, it's been an absolute pleasure this week. Thanks so much for all the shares, for all the love, and for all the support. You've been listening to America Emboldened with Greg Bolden on the America Out Loud Network. Be bold, America.